Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. One of the things that we talk about here on The Realignment are the big shifts going on in American politics and society today. Those shifts have left big openings for the populist forces of the left and the right to take advantage of declining American institutions.
With the end of the Cold War, the loss of American manufacturing jobs to China, the 2008 financial crisis, Brexit, and the election of Donald Trump, you had the upending of the conventional wisdom about the best solutions to our evolving policy challenges. In this vacuum, socialism in particular has come back with a vengeance, in large part due to a new generation of voters with no memory of the Soviet Union or the failures of North Korea or Cuba.
A few weeks ago, we brought Washington Post columnist Megan McArdle on the show to make the case for capitalism and the market. As a quick reminder, let's take a little bit of a listen to her case.
And so what markets do is they kind of magically, seamlessly allocate resources more efficiently than basically any other mechanism. If you think about the difference between that and what would happen in the Soviet central planning system, where the committee would have to get together and decide who got the tin, and there would be all of this bureaucratic infighting, and it wouldn't be based on how much people want the end use of the tin. It would be based on who has, you know, pull over the guy in the nomenklatura who, and so in fact, markets do this one thing incredibly well. They allocate uses to their highest valued use. And usually when we are complaining about markets, what we're complaining about is that the people in the markets don't value the things we think they should value.
You can hear more of Megan's case in episode 5 of The Realignment.
Well, as we said from the get-go, it won't always be about agreement on this podcast. So today, we follow up and are bringing you the other side's argument, a conversation with Bhaskar Sunkara, the founding editor and publisher of Jacobin, America's leading socialist magazine. Bhaskar was a socialist before it was cool, founding Jacobin out of his college dorm room back in 2010. He recently wrote The Socialist Manifesto, the case for radical politics in an era of extreme inequality, and he argues that a new form of socialism is the only answer to the challenges of the 21st century.
Let's dive in. Bhaskar Sunkara, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining.
Bhaskar, you're the author of this new book, The Socialist Manifesto. It's a term that's been thrown all around American politics in recent years. But what actually is socialism? And to add on to that, what is democratic socialism? Let's begin with the first part.
Well, socialists believe, at the very least, that society, our life results shouldn't be the result of accidents of birth. So at the very least, a society in which the bedrocks of life are access to health care, to basic nutrition, to housing, to child care, and so on. The other necessities of a good life are guaranteed to people by virtue of being born and aren't just mere accidents of birth or held hostage to the market. Beyond that, you know, the socialist tradition is broad and ecumenical. There's different strains of socialism. Some are good, some are bad. I think in particular, to say you're a democratic socialist is to say that you have a particular fealty to individual rights and to a certain bedrock of civil protections and whatnot. And our argument is not that we want to stifle this individuality, but that only with this bedrock fundamental social rights can we truly reach our potentials and flourish as free individuals.
Mm. So quick, what's a bad strain of socialism?
Well, obviously, there's Stalinism. There's all sorts of other cases. There's even cases of ideologies that call themselves socialists and that weren't even necessarily that authoritarian, but were just inefficient. And the slow tyranny, for example, of Nehru's India, where you had 3% growth rates when you could have had 5% growth rates, but you didn't have mass, executions and so on.
So, yeah, what? As the entire democratic field right now is being called socialist, as a literal socialist, what do you think about that? And are you worried about brand dilution?
No, I mean, this is America. It's 2019. And I think if you went back in a time capsule 30 years ago, the people associated socialism with breadlines and gulags. Now people associate it with Bernie Sanders and with the welfare state, with Scandinavia and so on. I mean, this is, in my view, progress. And it's a sign of your ideas winning and being compelling. But there's only one candidate with any serious background in the left or more broadly or more particularly in the socialist movement, and that's Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you actually write about how you've identified as a socialist for a long time. You were a socialist before it was cool. You said people used to react with surprise when you said it, but now they sort of shrug and say whatever. What changed?
Well, I think that there's been this attempt, and Jacobin, the magazine I founded, played a role in trying to articulate a set of politics to the left of mainstream liberalism. And what we were trying to do was fuse together different strands of the left together behind a new unified political program and to fill a void in American political life. In other countries, your left was literally communist in Europe, mm-hmm. Democratic communist, but communist. Or at the very least, social democrats in other countries, like in Canada. In the United States, the furthest left you could go was Rachel Maddow. So clearly there was the need for people to speak to anger. In the same way anger erupted on the right at the establishment, there was a simmering anger on the left as well. And the ground was set for something to fill that void. Thanks to Jacobin, thanks to the Democratic Socialists of America, we were able to call this simmering anger and this alternative democratic socialism. It might have been called populism, might have been called something else, but this is what it ended up being called.
So what was the left's anger of the Democratic establishment?
Well, fundamentally, the Democratic Party has, for at least the last 30, 40 years, been captured by a narrow layer of the professional middle class. It's been captured by the interests of finance, real estate, by Silicon Valley. It's been taken over by this group of people that fundamentally not just are pursuing policies in opposition to most working people in this country, but have a fundamental disdain for working people.
Mm-hmm. But here's the question, Bhaskar, which is, unifying elements of the left to the mainstream American left does not make you a socialist, in the same way that unifying elements of the right upset with the establishment right does not make you a fascist. So why is socialism the organizing principle by which you're calling this or governing it?
Well, fundamentally, we believe in a view of the world that says that working people united across genders, across races, and so on, have a set of common interests. And these common interests are rooted in their position in life, their relationship to, in the old Marxist parlance, the means of production. Mm-hmm. And in other words, what we're looking to do is organize these working people to win more power, to win more wealth, at the expense of a group of people in society that we don't just vaguely define as the elite, though that's a fine shorthand if someone was doing that, but we consider capitalists, right? The corporate interests and so on. So I think this program is a fundamentally left-wing program that's rooted in an ideology and that has a set of beliefs that's coherent. And there are a few people on the right that mm-hmm. are fascists. There are others that are, just angry, riled up conservatives. And same thing on the left. There's a group of people called themselves Democratic Socialists that are probably just fired up liberal Democrats. And then there's a group of people who have this further reaching ideological mission.
Okay. So one of the things I respect so much about your book is that you litigate some of the failures about the 20th century socialism. I actually would like to go through that. You say that it's key for socialists to learn the lessons of history. Where did the 20th century go wrong for socialism, particularly with the Soviet Union? Because if your whole thing is you're going to offer a new vision of socialism, let's go through and let's talk about what the problems of it historically are. Let's begin with the Soviet Union.
Well, there was a unified workers' movement that first emerged in the 19th century. And this came out of the fact that for the first time in the 19th century, there was a working class in itself. And this class was hoarded into cities. It was deprived of basic social rights. Its children had to work. People were literally disfigured by the time they hit their 20s and 30s. This is how the wealth and abundance of capitalism was created. But out of this came struggles for this class to be represented and to eventually form political parties. It fought for suffrage. It did all these things. This movement was unified. At the very least, though it had connections to the colonized world as well, across Europe, in both autocratic countries like Russia, mm-hmm. semi-autocratic countries like Germany, where the movement was actually at its strongest, and emerging more liberal democracies. And these are democracies, I would stress, that became more liberal under the influence of socialists and under the influence more broadly of this workers' movement. Now, where we took power initially and first was in Russia, and these countries that were coming out of civil war and world war were extremely underdeveloped. So you had a very small working class. In Russia, maybe 3% of the population in 1917.
It wasn't industrialized. So if you're talking about, it wasn't an industrialized country. You didn't have, this isn't Victorian England with horrible coal mines and factories that we're talking about here.
So you have a peasant base, kind of a workers' party that does have the support in this tiny 3% minority, or at least half of this 3% minority, coming to power but ruling over an underdeveloped, war-ravaged land with largely a peasant base. And the main question is, how do we develop? And this happened in China, too. How do we develop? And their approach to development was, for a period, actually quite smart with the new economic program of the late 1920s. It was able to harness, mid to late 1920s, which was able to harness some of the power of markets.
Are we boiling this down to the Soviet Union wasn't ready for socialism because they didn't have a industry that was ready to be collectivized? Is that basically what you're saying?
Underdevelopment, I think, was the key factor. I think you could go beyond that and say that there were severe inefficiencies in the particular manner of central planning that emerged in the Soviet Union.
Sure.
The particular brutality of Stalinism, I do not think was predetermined. It was kind of a bizarre confluence of factors. And I think in politics, we have to allow for that. Just in the same way, we wouldn't say that every single form of capitalism emerges as brutal as the Pinochet dictatorship and restructuring and whatnot. I think you could say the same thing about socialism, because when these very same parties imbued with the same ideology as the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks took power in Western Europe, first as conveners of coalition and minority governments in the interwar period, then leading governments in many countries, like in the Nordic countries in the post-war period, these are governments that respected rule of law, that
they had to
free
rule.
Transference of power and what. No, they established rule of law and they established democracy in many of these countries. Sweden was a hellhole. It was oligarchic. It was brutal. It was violent. And it was not a democracy until social democracy created and fostered democracy.
So you're saying in Western Europe, the point here is that those countries, the only reason why they didn't go about collectivizing, engaging in gulags was only because the communists chose not to do so?
Well, fundamentally, the social democrats figured out ways to create a functional socialism while still operating within the framework of capitalism. So they were able to politically administer the state, and then govern, but in the interests of working people. So they did pursue ultimately a different road, and there was a divergence in this unified movement between authoritarian strands of socialism that took root. I think the key question is, why were these authoritarian parts of the Marxist tradition kind of enhanced in Eastern Europe, whereas the same party with the same ideology went on a different path in Western Europe? And I think you can't just root it in ideology or root it in the writings of Marx or these other thinkers, because they have this common ancestor.
But it's not just in Eastern Europe. You see the failures in Cuba, North Korea, Venezuela, all of which took on these authoritarian tendencies. In fact, it seems that it's the exception to the rule to see the Western Scandinavian democratic socialism, or socialism as you call it, as opposed to how it's been exported and tried in all these other different places, especially throughout the Third World. What's the explanation for that?
Well, I think the a lot of the lessons of the Soviet experience apply very well to North Korea. The North Korea by the 70s and 80s is not even kind of proclaiming itself to be socialist. It's practicing its own bizarre form of autarkic nationalism. Cuba, you know, obviously, you could point to all the flaws of Cuba. Cuba's an authoritarian country. I don't support Cuba. But Cuba, compared to many of its peers, compared to the condition that prevails across much of the global south, has been able to at least give people basic levels of healthcare, basic levels of education. You don't see shacks and shanty villages in Cuba the way you do in Kingston, Jamaica, or even the very rich, you know, my family's from Trinidad, which is an oil-rich country in the Caribbean, but you still see kind of levels of poverty that I have not seen in my trips to Cuba. So our view is this, which is that there are this part of the socialist tradition, this communist movement that emerged and took power, has left a very bad legacy. Unlike most democratic socialists, I don't just say here, saying, you know, good socialism is the only real socialism and all these bad socialism isn't socialism. I am saying it does have some common roots in this tradition. It's been, though.
Well, look, so if you're looking at the places that were the exception to the exception, right? It's really those countries that were frankly protected by the United States during the Cold War, right? So part of the reason why you could argue that democratic socialists participated in the rules of democracy was that frankly they were constrained by Western liberalism. They were constrained by the conditions of the Cold War. It seems to me that there's a pretty consistent story here.
Well, they were constrained by particularly Western liberal traditions that came out of the common ancestor of the socialist movement, which was the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, of course, was always opposed by reactionaries and their conservative descendants because it always posed as its core fundamental goal equality, fraternity, and liberty. So socialism and liberalism, I believe, is due for a reconciliation at the level of I'm not an anti-liberal. In fact, my problem with liberalism is, in fact, that we can't realize many of these freedoms. We can't realize, in other words, a truly free press unless we could have state guarantees to education and literacy. So it's not that liberalism is bad, it's that it doesn't go far enough. And I would claim a lot of that tradition of Western liberalism more broadly for the left. But let's say in a country like the United States, I mean, most of us still get our Saturdays off. That Saturday wasn't a gift of God. Mm-hmm. God rests on the seventh day. The sixth day was won for you by a broad workers' movement with socialists heavily involved. Social Security, Medicare, protection in old age for our most vulnerable citizens. You could disagree with these programs, but these programs were won through struggle by the left in coalition, sometimes led by liberals. This has been the history of progress in the United States. And in Europe, you have similar situations where centrist agrarian parties are working with left-wing workers' parties, and they've been able to win substantial reforms. The society you're living in today would not be a society worth living in without the struggles of people who identify with the goals of liberty, equality, and fraternity.
Aren't you fudging the rules a bit, though, by saying that any worker protection is a result of socialism? I mean, every worker protection won in the United States, which is, remains a capitalist and a dynamic economy, does not mean that we, you know, that so that it is a triumph of socialism. It is a recognition, you're right, of concerns brought, but not just by the left, also by the right. How is it that you define the term? You very much are defining the terms and the rules of the game and saying that anything that benefits a worker has been won by a socialist.
Well, in the case of the United States, it's very clear that the coalitions between at times left liberal, but more often liberal left coalitions have won these reforms. In other countries, you are correct, where some of these reforms have been initiated by Christian democracy, for example, or by other forms of more paternalist state protection. So Perón probably was a manifestation of some sort of right nationalist manifestation. But again, this was in a context with a large mobilized workers' movement that was able to pressure. So whether in power or outside of power, I think it was socialists bringing these demands to the fore. And I think the legacy of the welfare state is a legacy of the left and a positive legacy. And it's one that I don't think it's fudging the facts to say that this was one of our primary goals. If you go back and read the Communist Manifesto, a lot of the demands have actually been won. The legacy of the last 150 years is not just a legacy defeat for us.
Well, at the same time, everybody who listens to this show, anybody who watches my show over on the Hill, they know that I love to dunk on China. But I have to give Deng Xiaoping credit, who was the leader of China after Mao Zedong. By embracing capitalism, he lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, largely at the expense of some of our own policies. But how would you view that phenomenon through a socialist lens? I've even heard Bernie Sanders credit China for using capitalism in order to lift so much of its population out of poverty.
Well, we had markets before capitalism. We'll have markets after capitalism. I think in the case of China, first of all,
do you have private ownership, though?
Well, no. China has actually left huge swaths of their economy in the hands of the state. It's been kind of a state managed liberalizing, not quite the free market kind of orgy that you would expect in other countries. Even on the right, when you've seen these rises of developmental states in Taiwan and South Korea, these used heavy elements of state protections. A Marxist would say that, you know, socialism only makes sense, it can only come about in conditions of abundance. Capitalism hasn't been an entirely negative phenomenon. In fact, it's been broadly progressive over the scope of its history. Perhaps it has some life left in us yet. But in my experience, when I think about the rise of liberalizing forces, when it's been done right, it's been done with a strong left-of-center government at its helm. The first two terms of the Workers' Party government in Brazil, I think, is a strong testament to that. The continued successes of the government in Ecuador, and particularly in Bolivia, and in the case of Bolivia, a very, you know, left-wing government overseeing the utilization of its natural resources, yes, even bringing in and allowing elements of private capital, but directing the proceeds of this growth towards social ends. So I think you need a strong state to figure out what industries do you expose to competitive pressures, what industries do you protect, and also what do you do with this increasing social product that you're getting?
I think it's important to speak to the actual program that you want to implement, right? So I alluded to this with a comment about ownership. How does, let's say I'm Marshall, the factory owner in the year 2025. Under your system, can I make a startup that I own? Can I create a factory that I own? How does ownership work in your society?
So fundamentally, I have at a normative level an objection to forms of hierarchy and exploitation I think are no longer necessary. So for example, in the workplace, we have to say, what do capitalists do particularly that they contribute to the production process? Well, in purely propagandistic terms, a socialist would say, oh, capitalism
is
a parasite and whatnot.
Why are we only speaking about production, right? That seems like you're acting as if the only thing that exists in the economy are traditional 19th century factories.
We're a service-based economy.
Productions of goods and services.
Okay.
Same thing.
Sure.
I think the extent to which we're just a service-based economy is something that is part and parcel with American decline. But
there's an agreement here. Yeah.
But when it comes to this example, what I was merely saying is that capitalists, if they're not purely parasites, they contribute something to production. So what do they contribute to production? So off the top of my head, two things. Entrepreneurial risk. So taking that leap, exposing your own assets to danger to start something new, to create places where goods and services can be produced, where people can be employed, there's that. And then also, day to day, they're managers of the production process.
Yes. And so you're saying that these things should be offloaded to the state?
No. What I'm saying is that workers themselves can collectively do those things. Workers can collectively write up a business proposal and a plan, use capital that they could get from a bank and start up their firms.
Yeah, but who owns the bank?
State banks can be run by independent managers.
So when is this system you're describing ever produce significant innovations, right? Because if you're looking at let's go down the list though, right? So if you're looking at Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak creating the first Apple computer, right? If you're looking at the iPhone, if you're looking at basically a lot of the sort of post 1990s internet era introductions, where is worker-managed and run system produced any of the sort of innovations we need to combat the really important things we have right now?
Well, so first of all, I'm comparing a system that exists theoretically with a existing system. So it wouldn't be fair to say, yes, it could have done it 100 times better.
Yeah.
I can point out right off the top of my head that the internet and these other things, of course, relied on a huge amount of state-led research and development. And
capitalists have no problem with that.
Capitalists used those technologies, which were developed by the state, in order to, the moon is what created the microchip, but Intel is what used the microchip in order to spur the burgeoning technology industry, which led to the Apple computer. It's not the state itself which directly subsidized the production of the Apple One.
But what we can think about in social democratic systems, let's say, because this is the closest, I don't see social democracy and democratic socialism as on different playing fields. Mm-hmm. I think social democracy is getting kind of within field goal range, and democratic socialism is a touchdown. I don't know if this is going to air. Football season just started. If you look at these social democratic systems, by having strong labor unions and sectoral bargaining agreement, you had tremendous wage pressure on the least efficient firms, and actually, indeed, higher rates of firm failure among less efficient firms than you do in our current system. But you also had the ability for these other firms who were able to survive in this environment to pursue labor-saving technology. You had robust use of active labor market policy, so people displaced from bad firms are getting retrained and getting into these expanding sectors. You had, in a way, a more dynamic system. So I imagine, in my vision of socialism, there'd be more firm failure, more innovation, more attempts to reduce human toil to expand leisure time and thus more automation in a context where that automation is not socially destructive and doesn't tear apart our bonds of stability and community.
When's the last time a social democracy created anything of true market distorting value? When's the last time an Apple computer was created out of Sweden?
So first of all, this is when you think about Nokia and you think about like the advances, particularly in cellular technologies that came out of the Nordic countries.
I was going to say, I think Nokia might be the last one.
Nokia's Finland though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but in the case of like Apple computers and these recent advances, this is a drop in the bucket compared to the what capitalism used to be able to do. I mean, the triumph of capitalism right now is
how you can't describe the iPhone as a drop in the bucket. The iPhone fundamentally reimagined the way that we interact with technology, reimagined cities, transportation, the whole lot.
The washing machine, transformed the lives of hundreds of millions of women and saved like.
Yeah,
many
it's a great
more
technology.
So trillions of hours of toil. What I'm
also
saying
a capitalist
like,
invention.
No,
yeah,
of course. Right. What I'm saying would be that dynamic of capitalism. So right now we're living in a capitalist society. Goods and services are produced in capitalist society. If we're having discussion in the 1400s, are you just going to repeat? Well, that grain we extracted from that peasant with a satchel strapped to his back is a feudalist invention. It's kind of a ridiculous line of argumentation.
So I think the context that's missing from this discussion is the fact that the U.S. doesn't operate in a vacuum, right? Like the U.S. is operating in a world where our geopolitical and economic rivals and allies, frankly, are dynamic, quickly, growing economies, right? If you're looking at what China's doing right now in artificial intelligence research, if you're looking what they're doing with surveillance technology, it seems to me that it's ridiculous to assume that we can basically just assume that we could shift our economic system during those sort of times.
Right.
You could argue, in post-1945, when we had this 20-year period where our allies and, frankly, our rivals alike were sort of in the doldrums, you could do that. But this seems to be the worst time to do that.
The average American worker is not in competition with the average worker in another country. The average American is in competition with their bosses, is in competition with the people who run the health companies that enslave them. They're in competition to all these other elite powers that are more often than not rooted domestically and rooted next door.
Now, but Bhaskar, the candidate that you support, Bernie Sanders, agrees with this vision, which is that these bilateral and multilateral trade agreements did directly withdraw capital and jobs for American workers in the United States to places like China and the rest of the third world. They are in direct competition.
Well, I think trade deals can be bad, trade deals can be good. I think we both have major criticisms of NAFTA.
Yes.
NAFTA was a bad trade deal. You can't tell unless you want to truly join a certain wing of the socialist movement and create Albania. We could all live in bunkers and grow our own produce. Mm-hmm. Then I think you're going to have to deal with different levels of trade. And in fact, there are certain sectors in the U.S., like U.S. agriculture, that I think is excessively protected. There's other sectors, like in manufacturing, then sure, I think there should be more tariffs. But fundamentally, what we're saying isn't we snap our fingers and we change a production system. What we say is we begin the process, the multi-decade potentially process of constructing a social democracy in America.
So
to begin with, Medicare for all in the next 5 years, I believe will be a reality. And this will there be economic ramifications? Yes, I think it'll be generally positive. But beyond that, the conditions that most Americans live in is not one that is reflected in this abundance we have. We're living in a more abundant country than in France, but we have worse social indicators.
Mm-hmm. So here's what I understand, though. I think socialists are at their strongest when they describe sort of a lot of the negative factors in American life, whether that's the cost of higher education, healthcare, poverty, etc. I think of where a lot of people jump off the socialist train is the idea that it requires abolishing private ownership, right? Like, why does the fact that we have lower social indicators than Sweden mean that you can't own a factory? That seems to suggest to me that we could have a universal basic income, which, by the way, is funded by the dynamic innovation that it seems like your system would, at a minimum, repress or basically gamble.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the very least, in the short term, what we're saying to people is that you deserve more. And you deserve healthcare, you deserve housing, you deserve childcare.
Okay, so let's as capitalists pass zoning regulations that make it easier to build cheaper housing. I don't understand why we have to then say let's abolish the ownership of property.
But we go beyond that, and eventually we say you deserve a seat at the table with the management of your workplace, and beyond that, you deserve a slice of the ownership pie. So the logic isn't at any point saying, oh, you don't get something. The logic of socialism is saying people get more and more. So we're not advocating – I am advocating, just to be clear, a state takeover of certain natural monopolies and other industries.
Which ones?
So, for example, healthcare. Medicare for All, by the way, is a hugely compromised demand. This is when Democrats often say they want the public option. You know, I want a national health service. You know, I want to put –
like in the United Kingdom.
Yes, exactly. I want to put hospitals under direct government ownership.
Yeah.
I want a more unitary system, so we don't have to deal with the petty fiefdoms that we have to deal with in state and local politics. But these are all compromised.
What do you mean, like the petty fiefdoms of state and local politics?
Well, just for,
you mean democracy?
No, democracy. We're talking about the fact that at the labyrinth of different legislatures we have in the United States often means that we can't make change at the national level without it being contested by a million different local courts and other things. And in other countries with more unitary systems, you do actually have democracy, but you have a democracy that's not built around the principle that paralysis is good.
So we are a country.
Just quick on this. So I just want to understand the program that we're advocating here. At some point, not immediately, you basically reconfigure the notion of what ownership in a society looks like. And then also, we basically reject the premises that you should be able to govern yourself locally. I think that's what's difficult.
No, of course you should be able to govern yourself in different strata of government.
But you called that a labyrinth, right? Like, you're obviously implying that it's bad that it has a city council.
And to latch on to this is the exact road on which autocracy and which oppression can lead through this type of thinking, which is that ultimately, I mean, you've said it, the labyrinth of democracy, the labyrinth of courts, and all these local and state jurisdictions are oppressing what your ultimate end goal is. I mean, centralized control is something that can ultimately be used to whatever end, and usually autocratic ends, and within these systems.
So I think we have to establish that there's a base level of civil liberties that no government should intrude upon. There is a private sector. There is a sphere where the state has no business in. We also should establish that, yes, at local levels, there's a need for forms of democracy and to creation of smaller bodies that can be more responsive.
In the year 2036, can I run a bank in your America?
You as an individual cannot run a bank in the kind of America that I envision. But you as an individual could work at a bank and can
work,
you know,
your way up to own part of it, and then eventually have a seat at
management. No. I think finance is one thing that actually has worked as in a public setting. In the same way, can you own a police department? No, I think there's certain standards that we apply for certain sectors, and I think a bank could be a part of a robust, accountable civil service.
So the other thing I want to get to here, and this we were alluded to this earlier, which is that all of this about the centralizing of control, Medicare for all of this, the total revamping of the American economy and changing our system is occurring at the exact same time that we're competing and are in utter geopolitical competition with China. Now, if you were to make our economy less dynamic and essentially much more of like the social democratic states of Scandinavia, the Chinese would be setting the rules in all of their emerging technologies. They are investing in AI, in biotech, and in so many of these other emerging technologies which will define the 21st century. Would we not be less free and more oppressed in a Chinese amoral-led world order?
Well, first of all, China's investing in these long-term technologies because they have a bigger role for state-led investment. Mm-hmm.
But
the innovations themselves have come out of the dynamism of the American economy.
Well, it's come out of the more established economy. But this is, in other words, I'm just the only part of the premise that I would push back against is this idea that when countries are doing catch up, this always happens. The U.S. steals technology from the U.K., China's stealing technology from the U.S. I'm not denying that it's not happening. But what the other thing I would pose is that the rise of China need not be a zero-sum game. More wealth is being created in the world. Medicare for All also doesn't necessarily make the U.S. less competitive. In fact, taking the burden of employer-sponsored health insurance might, in fact, help certain companies. Shifting that burden to the state.
It's questionable.
Once again, though, we could have some form of Medicare for all under capitalism. But here's my real question here. So let's pretend the year is 2036. I am incredibly successful. I've turned my think tank salary into this amazing venture fund. Why shouldn't I just move to Singapore? Right. So like, why is it? Because what you're really talking about here is changing the American idea itself. Why shouldn't basically all of the richest, most successful, most innovative people, your Stanford PhDs, just move to Singapore? Why, if I'm an entrepreneur, should I not just say, wait a second, I could just exit the U.S., go to a dynamic East Asian country, and then create all my innovation there?
Well, I think the goal is, again, to enhance the power of workers over huge spheres of the economy, and to build a society in which new goods and services are being produced anyway, collectively.
You mean worker control over a left-behind society? So sure, there was a lot of worker control in Albania, but they didn't really have that much to play over.
No, there wasn't any worker.
Man,
Yugoslavia had some, but there was none in Albania.
I confused my Balkans. Apologies.
But these are
worker control to what end? To what end?
That's the end. But the end
as a great nation is, and especially as in the American nation, is that our global hegemony and supremacy allows us to write these rules. Now, what I'm challenging you on is with this idea that we can coexist with China is that if they directly have more of a say over the rules of these emerging technologies and increasingly over the world trading system economically, that their illiberalism that they impose on that will make us all less free. And at the same time that they are doing this, you are proposing to make America a less dynamic and competitive state.
Post-war Europe, 1945. Yeah. We don't want to be that, I think.
Well, Europe has turned into a... I think most Americans would have been better off if they were born in Western Europe than they would have been born in the United States.
But Europe lives under the nuclear umbrella of the United States. They're only allowed to pursue so many of these things because we have such a high level of GDP defense.
As President Trump points out, they spend lower amounts on defense. They spend more on social welfare.
I don't think that's true. I mean, that was kind of... The peace dividend kind of logic of that's where the money for the welfare state comes from is not... just. It doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense.
Why?
Just the percentage of GDP doesn't make sense.
Who in Western Europe...
Greece spends more, I think.
But who in Western Europe is going to write the rules of the 21st century? These are dead and undynamic economies. Yes, they have great health care, but within 100 years, the point of a nation is to survive and to compete within this global order.
The point of most people's day-to-day lives is not opaque ideologies, be it socialist internationalism or nationalism. The point is to survive, to look after yourself, to look after your family. What I'm offering is a society in which your bedrock social rights are guaranteed by the state, in which you're
but
free.
But not a local democracy, though. So not your state legislature.
No, it could be the state legislature, but just not in the format where we're structured, with undemocratic upper houses, with things like the Senate. I think there is a need for a constitutional convention and for the creation of more responsive democratic forms. But what we're demanding is that people be given the freedom to reach their individual potentials and to take care of their families.
How?
And this ideology is an ideology that we want to spread and use the example of the U.S. to spread to other countries as well. I think the effect of even a social democratic United States will be a beacon of freedom for people in China, for people across the world.
That's not how that works. That's just like the people who said if we passed the Kyoto Climate Accords, the world would magically reduce its CO2 emissions. The notion, here's what would happen if the U.S. became a social democratic nation that by definition had to lower its defense spending. What would happen is an authoritarian China would run ramshod over East Asia. You'd have South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, most of our allies in the region under their sway. You would also see an international system that was authoritarian. I don't see how the Uyghurs in Western China would be able to say, oh, great, they have Medicare for all.
Right.
This is a free system now.
First of all, this is the ridiculous part of this is that you're not seeing China as a society just like the United States.
It's not. It's an authoritarian one.
It's a society compelled by people who have the same exact DNA, give or take, a tenth of a percentage from any of us, and who want the same things. They're going to fight for their own freedom and their own democracy, and they're going to change their own country.
And they're welcome to. The main point we're making here is that you talked about the ultimate, you want the state in order to guarantee your rights. The state can't guarantee your rights if the external pressures within that state come from illiberal regimes such as China. So if China is writing the rules that the way that America as a nation trades within the world system, the price of your goods, the state is not guaranteeing what you do. Beijing is. And just as, by the way, this is the whenever people criticize the United States as an imperialist power, this is what we're talking about, which is we do write the rules of the global order, and we enforce that rule through our defense spending and through our dominance in the international system.
Well, the United States is a very large country. Any change we make in the United States will have ramifications across the world. The United States will still play a leading role in the world due to our culture, due to our economy and whatnot, even if we have the basic levels of protection everyone else. So basically what you're saying is that this is a justification for why our children die at an earlier age than children in other countries, why it's more dangerous to give birth in the United States than other countries, why we have higher levels of child poverty. Oh, it's okay because, in fact, our children are dying so that Europe is defended and so that China's rise is arrested.
So here's the misnomer. Our children do not die because I'm incapable of starting a company and I don't have it be expropriated by the state. I completely agree we need to invest more in healthcare, social services, mm-hmm. outcomes of our people. That's why it's good there are countries having a conversation about universal basic income. But Andrew Yang is not arguing the way we pay every American $1,000 a month is we end private ownership. And also, to the question that wasn't answered earlier, what do we do when every single PhD who's creating innovative technologies wants to move to Singapore? Are you going to restrict their exit like East Germany
Let
did?
Them be Singaporeans then. Americans will construct a just society here at home.
A just poor society, right? We could be equal
I think
in our mediocrity.
The whole point is that we're talking about is that the greatest concern that we have, and Marshall was talking about this earlier, which is that it's not that we're going to get thrown into a gulag. It's that we're going to just be a lame nation that has no say in the affairs of the world. Like, why is that something that you want to see for us?
I, in fact, want to see a U.S. that's interventionist in a different way, that connects with movements of liberation, movements fighting for peace and justice across the world, that doesn't do so with bombs and drones, but does it with moral power and force. So Trump, for instance—
Moral power and force
so
is not going to free the Uyghurs.
Trump, for instance, caused a great deal of controversy when he had his call to Taiwan as one of his first acts as a head of state. I want one of President Sanders' first acts of his head of state to be a call to Lula in prison, to be a call to those oppressed and those struggling against authoritarian regimes to rally behind the banner of a different sort of United States and a different sort of policy. Mm-hmm. I think, in fact, what we believe in is a society with a different role. And you can go back, by the way, to Cuba. Cuba is not my vision of socialism. It's an autocratic country with many, many in dire need of a movement for basic freedoms. It has, for better or worse, been a beacon across the world of a different set of ideology. It has punched way above the weight of a tiny sugar-based economy of 9 million people.
Supported by the Soviet Union for 70 years.
If you actually look at the weight of Soviet subsidies or broader Eastern Bloc subsidies to the Soviet Union, to Cuba, it basically offsets the U.S. blockade and nothing more. But I think in the same way, if you're worried, if this is indeed your worry about prestige and dominance, no, I think, in fact, a Sanders-led administration led by internationalists would be far more compelling to people around the world than a Trump administration.
Well, we'll see. But because we're fair here, we have to give you the chance. One of the things you talk about in your book is socialism's second chance, that it's very rare for political movements and for political ideologies to get a second chance in world affairs. Yet, because of the 2008 financial crisis, you've been granted one. So what do you guys want to do with that second chance?
Well, I think at the very least, we have to see what works. Mm-hmm. I believe social democracy works. If indeed we can't go beyond social democracy, if the dream of worker ownership and whatnot is just that, an ideological dream, then we'll try it in small bits and we'll see it fail and it won't be pursued by the majority. But there is majority support for a basic common sense program of reform to grant people health care, to grant them greater protection in old age, to grant them a job, because people want to work hard and they want to contribute to society. And I think that our message is, this is what we want to give you, and we want to empower you to shape the rest of this program. Whatever becomes American socialism, American social democracy, whatever you want to call it, will be created by a mass of working people that is currently not that engaged, not that interested in politics, that thinks politics doesn't serve them anything. Mm. And these are the people who will be deciding things, not me or not you.
So our last question, we had Megan McArdle of the Washington Post on a few weeks ago to talk about the free market and capitalism. And though she's a capitalist, she definitely took some time to articulate some of the weaknesses. Under your best case 2036 scenario, what do you think are going to be the sort of bad spots of the political situation, of the system?
Of socialism.
Well, I don't think we'll be in a socialist society in 2036. I think we're going to have hopefully a system with guarantees to childcare, to healthcare. You're going to have certain inefficiencies that need to be weeded out, certain adjustments that need to be made. You're going to have to keep together a coalition. It's difficult. It's kind of easy to galvanize people to storm the gates. It's hard to make the compromises to build together a coalition. But I think it'll be a matter of tweaking and changing. You know, in Sweden, the Social Democrats ruled basically uninterrupted from the early 1930s until 1976. They had that opportunity to cement and grow kind of a base of reform. I think in the United States, what becomes our left egalitarian movement to change this country won't necessarily call itself a socialist movement. It won't be a very different, it'll use speak in a very American parlance. It'll hopefully have a place or have a role for people like me to be useful kind of left dissidents or people tripping. But I think
so. You're always going to be the left dissident, huh?
Well, I think what's key.
Own the brand. You got to own the brand.
Anything that we have in the future needs to be a fusion of both the socialist dreams and aspirations and fundamentally the goals of liberalism, which does mean that change has to be reversible, that in fact it has to be governed by laws and institutions, and that in fact it's not going to be a year zero break. There's many things in America that I admire. There's many things that we need to defend. I can't imagine a socialism worth its name without the Bill of Rights, for instance. But I also can't imagine a socialism worth its name without the Senate. Mm. So that's what I mean by the type of change we need institutionally. But I am a socialist because I love the United States. I love the people in it. And I believe we deserve a better future. Mm. If people are socialists because they don't like the United States, because they think we're this great force for evil that sees within every single ordinary American a closeted racist or homophobe or whatever, then they're not going to be able to convince those very people to make change. And that should be obvious, but it's apparently not even obvious to some of the Democratic Party frontrunners right now.
Well, with that, Bhaskar Sankara, thank you for putting up with us. Thank you for joining The Realignment. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Sagar and I are really excited to have the opportunity to debate both sides of the most important issues facing our country, and we're looking forward to doing so in future episodes.
Again, make sure to listen to Megan McArdle's Case for the Market, if you haven't yet, in episode 5 of The Realignment.
Please subscribe and rate us 5 stars. We'll see you next week.